Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting, but not video streaming today. I'm on location. We're going to talk about the latest ways of living a longer life, new research from National Institutes of Health and the National Institutes on Aging. But we also have a lot of audio-video clips to share with you that I think are very relevant. For example, we have one by a young woman, Claire Winland, Make Your Life Beautiful, and it's for all those people who feel very sorry or pity people who are sick. And what she is going to suggest to us that don't pity people who are sick, that disempowers them. Empower them. I think you'll find it very interesting. Then we'll open that up for discussion, and you can call in and share your points of view. Also, McDonald's, never again. We'll tell you about McDonald's. And we were told that Hurricane Maria that slammed into Puerto Rico wasn't that bad. Yes, it was. More people were killed in Puerto Rico because of Maria than died at 9/11. So why hasn't this been a national issue to see what could prevent further degradation of the country and its people with the next storm that will be coming? Also, it was Montel Williams who allowed Gary Webb an opportunity to expose the CIA as a major purveyor of drugs coming in the United States. Very few people will have remembered that if they saw it at all. We're going to remind you about how corrupt, how deep it goes in setting people onto a course of destruction by providing them with cocaine in return. That money went right back to buy arms to arm the Contras, who themselves were terrorists, supported by the United States. So that's the broad layout today. We have a lot to share, but we always begin with the latest on health and healing. A new study just out, published in Cell Metabolism, shows that increasing the time, and I mentioned this several times in the last 2 weeks, increasing the time between your last meal and your first meal is going to help you live a longer life. It's a form of modified fasting. So daily fasting, by taking longer to eat your last meal and before your first meal. For example, let's say you eat your last meal at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, and then you have 12 hours before you eat your next meal, which would be breakfast, at 6 or 7 a.m. That really helps you. It extends overall lifespan, and that's what this study showed. And also, if you could eat, drink more of your meal, meaning have smoothies with all the nutrients in them. And I've gone over this many times, what should go into a healthy smoothie. So that's something to consider, because it changes your metabolic rate, it improves digestion, it helps you relax more because you're not all bent into digestion, so something to try. From the University of Auckland, zinc is found to reverse brain cell changes in autism. Now, we have parents listening, and we had at one time diagnosed autistic kids listening. In fact, just yesterday, by coincidence, I ran into a person who I counseled about 14 years ago. I then recently counseled him and his children again to give him a new updated protocol. And when we bumped into each other, he said, I was on my way from work. And he said, I just want to tell you that I'm seeing major, major, major improvement in my son just in the last 3 weeks. I said, good. So, and the son is taking zinc, among other nutrients. But cellular changes in the brain caused by mutations that you see in autism frequently, but not exclusively due to vaccines and the chemicals and vaccines that are known to be neurotoxic, like zinc, like aluminum and mercury. But according to the University of Auckland, medical scientists and the Department of Physiology have researched aspects of how autism's mutagens change brain cell function over a five-year period. And they found that zinc is very, very important in that process of helping protect the brain. So, quote, this study looks at how zinc can alter brain cell communication that is altered going wrong at the cellular level in the brain. So quite simply, it helps prevent the brain from becoming more disorganized in a child with autism. So something simple, inexpensive, easy, 10 to 15 milligrams a day of zinc for everyone. And then if your child has autism, make sure they have it. From the Cochrane database, that's a group of scientists, they say that there's high-quality evidence that vitamin D can reduce asthma attacks. And this was looking at randomized trials, people just taking oral vitamin D every day. Now, we know that asthma is a common chronic disease. It affects about 300 million people worldwide. Generally, you have wheezing, coughing, chest tightness, and shortness of breath. And vitamin D is a supplement that impacts, in a positive way, asthma attacks and reduces the symptoms of lung function problems in children and adults. So that's important. So vitamin D3 to help you with asthma. A new study published in Phytotherapy Research indicates that hot flashes decrease by 48% when people used a fenugreek, 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 and they simply used an extract to benefit those suffering from those particular hot flash menopausal symptoms. And they weren't even using a large amount, just 1,000 milligrams a day for 90 days was found to offer, quote, significant hormonal balance by enhancing the estradiol levels, an estrogen that was shown to play a key role in menopausal discomforts. So, and it was safe. So add fenugreek at 1,000 milligrams to help you if you're suffering from hot flashes. I remember when we first started hearing about nano, that's N-A-N-O, particles. Now, nanoparticles are about 1,000th the size of a human hair, making them very difficult to see. But they're everywhere. They're in a lot of medicines. They're used in industrial manufacturing. And they're ubiquitous in our environment. This is the first study of this type I've seen. This is from Lancaster University, which is in the United Kingdom. Quote, toxic air pollution nanoparticles discovered in the human brain. So tiny magnetic particles from air pollution have for the first time been discovered to be lodged in human brains. And researchers think that they could be a possible cause of Alzheimer's disease. So that's important. And they're saying that they found abundant magnetite is the nanoparticles in the brain tissue of 37 individuals. And that's not good. That means that they're in our environment, we're breathing them in, eating them in, and they migrate right past the blood-brain barrier, and they get into our bodies and our brains. That is not good. There's a new fruit. It's not new to the people who have been using it for a long period of time in Malaysia, but this is from the University of Nottingham, and it talks about the Asham Keping, let me spell that, A-S-A-M, Asham Keping, K-E-P-I-N-G. And it's a fruit that comes from the Asham Keping tree. And they're saying use it to prevent atherosclerosis, that's the hardening and narrowing of your arteries. And that's according to the University of Nottingham's research team. So it's just a tropical fruit. It's locally called Asham Keping. And they use it for heart disease. They've been using it a long time. So they did research on it and found, yeah, this thing works. So anytime there's something that's natural, non-toxic, and can make a difference, like a functional food, meaning a function is in a positive way, I want you to know about it. And they did 3 years of painstaking research on the medicinal role of plants in preventing atherosclerosis, and this came right up at the top of the list. Now, there's another plant out there, cacao, C-O-C-O-A, and that's chocolate. According to Seoul National University in South Korea, it reduces wrinkles. Now, we know it's good for the heart. We know it's good to lower blood pressure. We know it's good for vitality. It's got rich polyphenols that help our brain. Well, eating cacao can reduce the ultraviolet light-induced wrinkles. Too much sun? Try this. This was published in the Journal of Investigative Dermatology. And, quote, it was especially beneficial in improving condition of the skin. So, eat your healthy chocolate. And most of the commercial chocolate you see historically in the country has very little of the cacao in it. It mainly has milk and sugar. And that's why now good chocolates rate themselves. And most of the commercial chocolates are like 10, 15% cacao. The healthier chocolates are at 50, 55. The super healthy ones are 65. And at 70 up, you're the superstar range. That's the best of the best. Increased vitamin D levels over time associated with reduced homocysteine concentrations, University of Alberta. This is really important. Why? Because when you're lacking vitamin B complex, specifically B6, folic acid, B12, and vitamin C, and trimethylglycine, those are the nutrients that hold down your homocysteine level. Now, you can't fail homocysteine, and most doctors never test for it. But when that's elevated, let's say it's at around 15, 16, 17, 18, you're at a really increased risk of a heart attack or stroke. It's an inflammatory marker produced by your liver. So, by taking vitamin D, you're lowering your risk of homocysteine. That was published in PLOS One, uncovered the association between lower homocysteine levels and increased levels of serum vitamin D3. And that's good. Also, for those people believing that grilled and fried or baked foods are good for you, they're not. And when you watch these cooking shows, and it's all artificial. Like, okay, you've got 12 minutes to do this. Why? Why 12 minutes? What's the point? Well, they have to have some competition. They have to have people winning and losing. They have to invite the winner back and boo the loser. All these things are just stupid because it has nothing to do with reality. Because I can assure you that the average homemaker, male or female, is not going into the kitchen and then someone starts a stopwatch and they rush frantically to make a dish, and then it clicks at a certain time and it has to be done, or if it's not, well, that's what you get. No one does that. So they create an artificial environment, an artificial protocol, an artificial standard, highly competitive, winners and losers. This is bread and circuses. This is the Roman theater. And then almost everything they cook is bad to begin with. Well, this is from the Mount Sinai School, the Carl Icahn School of Medicine there, that changing the way you cook could help reduce your risk of getting type 2 diabetes. So if you poach, that's safe. If you steam, that's even safer. But if you fry, grill, or bake, that's not. And that's put you at greater risk of creating inflammation, and that then helps lead to diabetes. Of course, raw is the best. And juicing is terrific because raw foods and juices help lower blood pressure, help lower cholesterol, help lower triglycerides, and they help maintain a better blood fasting level. So, and finally, I want to just share a few things about mushrooms. This is from the Imperial College of London, new research on mushrooms to treat severe depression. And this is a relatively new study coming out of the United Kingdom. And it's now using science to confirm what many people have known for centuries, that a particular cybin, which is a byproduct that is hallucinogenic, it's a chemical found in these magic mushrooms, was able to lift and treat severe depression in humans. So generally, they don't do this kind of research, but when they did, it was very positive. And this was published in the Lancet Psychiatric Journal. So that's good. Oh, and by the way, one last thing from Vienna University. People in unhappy relationships are more likely to have suicidal thoughts. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, but that's what they're saying, and I think we could all understand why. I've said a long time that don't try to prove to other people in your life that you're capable of thick and thin and better or worse, because once you accept that it's worse, it almost never gets better. And then you learn to tolerate, and you maladapt down to the person's level that you have to tolerate. And then as long as you've learned to tolerate them, you think that that's a successful relationship. It isn't. You're abiding by someone else's artificial notion of how you should be complicit in a social contract that should have been torn up and thrown away a long time ago. And someone wrote me an email, wasn't very literate. In fact, it clearly showed that the person had an agenda. Why? Because they were, you know, throwing these stupid little remarks about, well, you said that people shouldn't get married, have children, and buy a house, and yet you got married, you had a child, and you bought a house. And that's correct. But what the person left out of what I said was the following. That based upon today's economy and the uncertainties we live in the world today, and based upon how many bad parenting skills exist and how this has impacted the children who are vulnerable and are impressionable to adults who themselves are not in happy relationships, themselves are careerist or not, and don't have the quality time to put into proper and healthy child rearing that once was a given. There was a role for the father and a role for the mother. Today, a lot of people think that they're absolutely right on mark, and if they have everything else in life, a lot of careerists, especially women, says, well, the only thing I'm lacking now to put on my mantle is a child. As if it's a trophy, something to acknowledge that they have succeeded at everything. They were summa cum laude, they from Harvard, they're now making $1 million a year and a junior partner in a Wall Street law firm, and they've got their own house in the Hamptons, and et cetera. Well, but they don't have a child. So at 45, now's the time to have a child. Now, of course, will they give that child unconditional quality time? No, they can only give the child what they have. And that's going to be highly impatient, highly judgmental, perfectionistic towards everyone else but not themselves. They are hypercritical because they've always been in a position to direct the energy from them to others, not receive it in return. So they're not open to improvement, change, or any form of self-examination. So the child's going to end up just growing up to be a miniature version of this mess of a man or woman. And most people today, let's be honest, just be honest, most people are a mess on a curve of varying degrees to where they're a mess, but they're tolerable because most of their problems they don't bring upon us, to where they publicly display their mess, like a president of the United States or most everyone else that you see in public office. So in that context, they're not going to be a good parent. And they're not going to give unconditional time. And they're going to be glued to the feedback they need, that artificial stimulation, that they're still relevant. They can't let themselves get out of that cycle of constantly being the center and micromanaging their lives and everyone else's. So in that case, that would be a bad time to have a child. If you don't have an authentic life, you only have a career, then you better work on yourself. Also, think of the people who are growing up now who are poor. There's a simple economic reality. You're going to spend more than $150,000 between birth and the age of 18, when legally that child is able to go out on their own. And even though you're a parent, maybe a good parent, that child's responsible for themselves. In today's world, you have to look at what is happening now. It's going to get worse. Nothing's going to get better. For people who are living, at least half of the American population, living at or below the poverty line. So do you really feel it's fair to bring a child into this abject poverty, the sense of loneliness and isolation, the sense of despair, because all these epigenetic energies you're going to infuse into that developing fetus. So the child has got two strikes against them before they're even born. And then look into the eyes of a child who was an unplanned or unwanted child, and there are millions of them in the United States, and ask yourself, do I really know what it is to be important in someone else's life? And if so, why don't I start by being a big brother and a big sister, spending quality time with someone at the end of the day? I can go home, and they go back to their shelter. And see, can you handle that? Not for a day or a week, but over a period of months or a year. That changes the calculus on it. So we have people rushing into relationships, rushing into marriage. In fact, a reality show is that you don't know a single thing about the person until the day you actually marry them. How stupid is that? Is that the dumbest thing you've ever heard of? Some producer thought that would be a good idea, to have total strangers not know a thing about each other and just have to work it out. Yeah, let's see how that works. Go back a year later and see how many of them are together. But it's good for ratings, and that's all we care about today. Everything is theater. Everything is a show. And by the way, do you think we'd have a Me Too movement today like we do if there were no famous names involved? If there's no Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby or Bill Clinton or Kevin Spacey or any of the, or James Franco? They gave him a pass, didn't they? What if it was just women being harassed and women, and that's always been the case for those who do not respect women. But it only becomes an issue when it's someone famous. Why shouldn't it be an issue all the time? Why should women's rights be deferred or denied or forgotten until sometime that a famous person is involved? That to me is extremely elitist and shows the true nature of disdain. It's just like saying we care about women. Hence, we want a woman president who cares about women issues. And then that same woman candidate for president, Hillary Clinton, brings into the sanctum of the State Department Saudi Arabia, one of the biggest abusers of women in the world. How do you possibly reconcile these types of hypocrisies that are palpable? But that's all we have today is hypocrisy. Everywhere you look, there's hypocrisy. So imagine now, you think you would be good in a relationship, but you don't have a good relationship with yourself. You've mastered nothing but your career and your personality and the stories that you sell to other people. We don't encourage anyone in America to take quality time and introspection to find out who they are and what their mission is. Other countries, it's a given. Go anywhere else in the world and you won't find massive depression and anxiety and suicide and disrespect and lack of morals, because they grew up in a family. We just think that's so old-fashioned. That's just stupid. Yeah, stupid? No, stupid is spoiling a kid, and now they're 23 years old, graduated from college, don't have a job, and spend their whole day masturbating to porn on your computer while you're out working your ass off. That's stupid, all right? And you think that's going to change? No, it's not. I haven't seen problems change to solutions in 95% of people. 5%, yes. 5%, yes. So then you go buy a house. Well, exactly how are you going to pay for the house? Look at all the people who thought they should have a house and bought a house and signed liar's loans and got their house and then lost their house and had to go through that deep, dark space in their life where they had no friends, their neighbors weren't their friends, nobody was willing to help them, the government didn't help them, the state didn't help them, the city didn't help them, their friends didn't help them, and the only people that were willing to help them were their families. So they became couch surfers, sleeping on couches or making an extra bunk in an attic or a basement or a garage. So exactly what should you do when you get married? Buy a house? Historically, yes. There was a time when a larger family was essential. There was no Social Security. There was no welfare. There was no support. There was no union supporting your issues. So if you got older and you didn't have a family to supporting you, you starved to death. You died. And so that family is very important, but we don't have to have the large families we once had. Having a home at one time was not about an investment in real estate. It was about having a place that you could pass down generation to generation. Well, today, it's about proving your value. You've made it. You can buy a house. Well, did you pay cash for it? If you didn't, you shouldn't own it. Rent, don't buy. It's a wrong time. Because who motivated you to say that that's the American dream? Corporations. That's just part of the Edward Bernays, the master publicist at the beginning of the 20th century, who convinced people you should buy stuff you don't need, things that are actually bad for you, the profit goes to the corporations. So buying a house after getting married, when you have no income, that's not the thing to do. And then to get married. Who says you should get married? Historically, you were expected to get married, have children, get a house, and those who did, by the 1970s, had equity. They didn't have credit cards, so they had no debt. They had savings. They learned lessons from their parents. So when you consider who benefits from you buying a house, big corporations and the banks, financial institutions, who benefits when you can't pay your mortgage? They increase your percentage of interest. Who benefits when you have a kid and you got to spend a lot of money on him? So you start to look at the financial incentives to get married, have children, buy a house. It worked at one time and it worked for a long time and it was necessary. Not today. Not today. So unless you're of a special group, if you're ultra-Orthodox, it is essential because you're not living as an individual autonomous with your own decision-making. You've agreed to live as a part of a group where the person, the titular head, generally the patriarch, is passing down centuries of beliefs, and your life is simply an examination, an exemplification of the belief system that you're a part of. So if it says have a lot of children, you have a lot of children because you're not alone. There's a whole community that is giving support. That's different than the modern urban independent thinker today. So there are exceptions, but when you look at it in the different context that I just shared, it's a whole different outcome. We're going to take a break and come back, and when we come back, we're going right into this audio tape. We're going to listen to Claire Winland talk about she has cystic fibrosis, but don't pity her. That's what she's saying. See if it makes sense to you.
I have something called cystic fibrosis, but I'm actually not here to depress you all about cystic fibrosis. I'm actually here to talk about how do we change the way that we treat sick people? And we stop pitying them and we start empowering them. The way that our society works, we teach sick people that when they are sick, somehow, some way, they cannot be as happy as normal, healthy people, right? We teach them that their happiness, their contentment in life, their joy in life is tied to how healthy we are. And I remember I was around 7 or 8 years old, and I was like flipping through this magazine, and there's this really beautiful picture of like this artist in like their New York loft apartment. And I'm sitting there and I look around my hospital room and I'm like, I wish I was there. And I had a moment where I was like, but I'm stuck in the hospital. And I thought, well, you know, there's a Target right down the street that has some twinkle lights and some throw pillows. And I have a room. I have furniture. Why don't I make something out of this room? Why don't I deck it out? So me and my nanny decided to completely redo the hospital room. And I don't mean like just put some pictures on the wall. I mean like completely redo the room. We were like moving around the furniture. I was like sweating. My machines were beeping. The nurses were coming in like, what are you doing? You're crazy. And by the end, we had completely transformed the room. And nurses and doctors from all over the hospital came in to see it. And so every time I ended up going into the hospital, I would deck out my hospital room. I started to realize that people who are sick, and nurses and doctors as well, everyone in the medical community, everyone in the healthcare community, get so stuck in this notion that a hospital room is this cold, sterile, white place where we go to be sick. And that's all that it can be. And we get so stuck in that that we cannot see the possibility. We can't see what we can make out of it. We don't see what we can do with it. I started realizing that our lives, in a way, are like this, right? Our lives are like empty hospital rooms. We get so stuck in the idea that, oh, it's supposed to be good or bad. If we're sick, well, you know, then it's cold and it's sterile, and we just have to live with it like that. We don't let ourselves realize, we don't let ourselves see. We can make that hospital room beautiful. We can make our lives into a piece of art. We all have that ability, we all have that capability as human beings to turn these empty hospital rooms, to turn these lives into something really beautiful. We look at people who are sick and we pity them because we believe that their sickness means their life has to be inherently less joyous than everyone else's. Yes. Life is not going to stop unfolding itself to you just because you're sick or just because your life isn't how you think it's supposed to be. There's still going to be beauty. And I can honestly say a majority of the happiest moments in my life have been when I'm sick in the hospital. Honestly. And think about the implications of that. Because I have lived the kind of life that all of you spend your entire lives running from. I've been sick and dying my entire life. And yet, I am so proud of my life. What does that say? No, really, what does that say about the way we're all living our lives? We're waiting to be healthy. We're waiting to be wealthy. We're waiting to find our passion. We're waiting to find our true love before we actually start living. Instead of looking at everything that we have, looking at all the pain, looking at all the sadness, looking at all the beauty, and making something with that. That's how innovation happens. Innovation doesn't happen because there's some person who's in a great circumstance and everything's going well and like, you know, and they just get on a roll and they make something for the world. Innovation happens, art happens because of suffering. And when we clamp down to that suffering, when we teach people who are sick, when you teach a little 7-year-old me that because I'm sick, I don't have anything to give to the world. I don't have anything to create. So I want to encourage you all, next time you meet someone who's suffering, who's in pain, instead of shutting down, instead of pitying them, why don't you think, I bet their life is so beautiful. Really look at them and think, I bet their life is so complex and beautiful. We all get to be a part of this giant human epic story, right? We get to be a part of human history. We get to add to it. We have something to give. And we realize it's what we're creating that matters. It's what we're adding to this beautiful story that matters. When we start looking at that, we can change the world.
I think that's very important. What she is, from my perspective, what she is saying and living is that she's not irrelevant because of her diagnosis. Nor was Helen Keller. Nor was one of the greatest artists of all time, the great French painter who painted in the Folies Bergères, Lautrec. Think of all the people that we would have felt sorry for them or pity them because of some physical abnormality. Think of Stephen Hawking. Didn't limit him from thinking, from expressing, from feeling. So that's why I say that in my entire career, I never have a discussion about the disease a person comes presenting with. Because what I have found is that they become their disease. They become the physical manifestation and the mental possession of a disease. They come as a cancer. I'm dying. There's no hope. Who says you're dying? Well, the doctors. So you've given the power over your life to a stranger because they're supposed to know. So when you empower people and you focus upon what would you like to do with your life, what have you not done? What if everything was yes and there were no no's? What would be different? And suddenly a whole new energy begins to emerge from them, where before it was my story of woe. I'm a victim of this disease. And now it's not. And that's where they begin to take the hero's journey. And that's a journey always of optimism and hope. And that's what we should be encouraging. Now, I want to go over to a different and I'd like your input, too. Please call 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear what you think. 888-874-4888. And we're going over now, and we're going to hear about McDonald's Never Again. It's a short clip.
McDonald's, anywhere in the world, you will find French fries, or chips, as you call them, and you will find that they're always made from the same potato, the russet Burbank potato. This is a potato from America that's unusually long and difficult to grow. But that's what they want, because when you're McDonald's, you like those red boxes with a little bouquet of very long chips. It looks really good. And so they insist that all their potatoes be russet Burbanks. And they further insist that they have no blemishes at all. There's a very common defect of russet Burbank potatoes called net necrosis. And you've seen potatoes with a little brown line sometimes or spots that come through it. Well, McDonald's won't buy them if your potatoes have that. And the only way to eliminate that is to eliminate an aphid. And the only way to do that is with a pesticide called Monitor that is so toxic that the farmers who grow these potatoes in Idaho won't venture outside into their fields for 5 days after they spray. And then when they harvest their potatoes, they have to put them in these atmosphere-controlled sheds the size of a football stadium because they're not edible for 6 weeks. They have to off-gas all the chemicals in them. So you see, the desire for a certain kind of chip leads to a certain kind of agriculture. But the other thing on the health side, when I started learning about nutrition, about which, by the way, much less is known than you might think, that the scientific understanding of nutrition is still very primitive. But I learned that what mattered most about one's health was not necessarily the nutrients, good or bad, that you were consuming or staying away from, or even the calorie counts. But what predicted a healthy diet more than anything else is the fact that it was being cooked by a human being and not a corporation. Corporations cook very differently than people do. They use vast amounts of salt, fat, and sugar, much more than you would ever use in your own cooking. And the reason they do that is those are three incredibly attractive and incredibly cheap ingredients. And when they're layered properly, as in a chip or various pastries and forms of junk food, they're incredibly addictive. And in fact, people in the industry, they don't talk about addiction in the food industry, even though they traffic in addiction, they talk about craveability. It's the same thing. And snackability is another term they use. It's a lovely word. Anyway, so I came to see that cooking has a huge bearing on our health. And in fact, there's been a lot of research in America that shows that even poor women who cook have healthier diets than wealthy women who don't. So you see, the usual class bias in the quality of diet is overtaken by this fact, this key fact. Who's cooking your food?
See, it's a truth. He is incorrect when he says there's little science. There's an abundant science. There's over 500,000 articles on the science of nutrition. He's just not familiar with them, but he's absolutely correct about the French fry. Now, if you want to make your own baked French fries on low heat, and you can actually do it in a food dryer at 115 degrees, so it's still technically a raw food. You have not altered the antioxidants or the nutrients or phytonutrients or chlorophyll or the starches. You've simply made the starches more compatible with proper digestion. And yet it looks like and tastes like a French fry, but it has another saturated fats, the trans fats, the high sodium, and refined carbohydrate too quick and to digest and too fast to raise the blood sugar. Something simple. Now, we're going to play one more clip. And again, I have open calls if you want to call in. That young lady's name was Claire Winland, W-I-N-E-L-A-N-D. I want to play this clip about, let's see what time we have. Yeah, I'll play this. This is about Gary Webb, someone who I know very well, introduced him to his publisher, Dan Simon, Seven Stories Press, was there as a friend the night at Columbia University School of Journalism when he won the Investigative Journalist Award, which he really deserved for the courage it took and the quality of his investigation on the CIA sponsoring drugs coming into Los Angeles and money and cash going back out to buy arms to send to the Contras that the administration was giving in South America and Central America. Here's Gary Webb on the Montel Williams Show exposing the CIA.
First, and then we'll talk about the issues. It was about a cocaine ring that operated along the west coast of the United States throughout most of the 80s. And they were funneling, they were selling cocaine in South Central. They were also selling it in Oakland. They were selling it in San Francisco. They were selling it in San Jose. And some of the money they were making was going to support an army that the men who ran the cocaine ring worked for, called the FDN. This was an army that the CIA started in 1981 and supported.
Better known to us, most of us who remember the news, the Contras, right. In Nicaragua. So go right ahead.
The men that were running the cocaine ring were top officials of this Contra army. And what we found was that they were selling this stuff in South Central, which is, you know, predominantly black section of Los Angeles, immediately before the outbreak of the crack cocaine epidemic. They started selling powder. Tons and tons and tons of powder cocaine was going into this one small area of the city. And from there, they sold it to Freeway Rick. And Freeway Rick took the powder, turned it into crack, and starting in 1983, 1984, began distributing it to predominantly the gangs, the Crips and the Bloods in Los Angeles. And they spread it, you know, from there.
From there. Now, since this has happened, you have butted heads with everybody in Washington, D.C., trying to get information about the story, have you not?
Yeah. We worked on this for a year. And it was only because, you know, some people at National Archives believe freedom of information means freedom of information. We got some documents that showed that pretty strongly there were some CIA connections to this.
Let's talk a little bit about those documents for a second. Because there's a gentleman, this figure that we talked about yesterday on the show. His name is Blandone, Danilo Blandone, who was a person who was a member of the aristocracy of Nicaragua before the fall of Somoza. And then he fled and comes to the United States and decides, while he's in the United States, so you can all understand this, he wants to raise money for their revolutionaries who are trying to overthrow the government that just overthrew them. Right. So here in the United States, they try to do fundraisers, and that doesn't work. And then right. Blandone gets a scheme. Well, I can get some cocaine cheaply with some help from some of my friends and get it into the United States of America. All I need to find is somebody who can sell it. So they find a gentleman by the name of Rick Ross, who is Freeway Rick. Rick Ross comes in and starts selling cocaine at the term's beginning, 1 or 2 grams, and within weeks, 2, 3, 4 kilos a week. within months, what was it, 10 to 15 kilos a day. Ricky Ross was selling cocaine to the point of making $3 to $4 million a day. He sold so much cocaine, it hurt his fingers to count the money. Not only in Los Angeles, but in Cincinnati, in St. Louis, all the way across America. So some can say, and this is the reason why people are so angry at you in your article, is that Ricky Ross, the dope dealer, was supplied by the CIA because Blandone was an operative for the CIA, correct?
Blandone and Meneses were working for an army that was a wholly owned subsidiary of the CIA. They were meeting with CIA agents. Blandone, and this came out in court. I mean, Danilo Blandone is now a government witness. He works for the Drug Enforcement Administration. And we've paid him, I don't know, $166,000 over the last 18 months because he's such a good informant. So they put him on the witness stand in Ricky Ross's case. And he testified that in 1981, he went to Honduras. He met with the commander, the military commander of the CIA's army. And he was instructed to go raise money in California for this Contra army. And he was told that the ends justified the means.
And those ends being sell cocaine if you
have to. Well, look, he was in the room with the Nicaraguan representative of the Cali cartel, Mr. Meneses, and he was in the room with a government marketing expert named Danilo Blandone. Now, if they weren't talking about selling cocaine, I don't know what they were talking about.
And this is all information they can find on a website. I have to use that website. But on a website on the Internet. So we're going to put that up so people can go
you
and
can
research,
look at these documents
take
yourself.
A look at the documents yourself and judge it. But Michael, now, I mean, there's a stretch here. Here's a guy who is obviously a CIA operative, Mr. Blandone, who is working with this government-backed army that we've kind of created in Nicaragua. But how the heck does this guy get to bring in tons of cocaine? When I say tons, I'm talking tons. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 tons of cocaine weekly in the United States of America for 7 years, and no one can ever catch him.
Well, number one, Mr. Meneses was actually indicted in 1984. He was known within my own sources in DEA told me he was known as el rey de la droga, the king of drugs. He was in more than 40 files and indicted mysteriously, and people within DEA say that it was CIA intervention that kept this sealed indictment from ever being opened. So he was well known. He's well known. The connection between him, Blandone, and Calero, who was the head of the Nicaraguan government in exile, is clear. There's a clear evidentiary.
Well, we got a picture of him.
Yeah, there's a clear evidentiary trail. Now, if you want to follow that trail up, you have to first understand how CIA and DEA work. I was a country attaché assigned to Argentina. Now, during those years, there were people who I inherited on the payroll who were murderers. They were also on the CIA payroll.
So murderers. On the CIA payroll.
Not only murderers, I'm talking about mass murderers. And I wrote about it in books that I thought would have America marching on Washington. Nothing
Michael,
ever happened.
How are you alive today?
A miracle. Just absolutely.
Why didn't the CIA bump you off before you came to the Montel Williams show? Because to me, they will say tomorrow, he's a kook. He's crazy. Right. Don't believe anything he has to say. Don't worry about it. There's no conspiracy.
Well, at the same time, DEA called me one of their best in a New York Times article. The only thing I can say, Montel, I lost my son. I lost my brother because of this phony CIA-backed drug flow. Somebody once said that if you don't have anything in your life to die for, you don't have anything to live for. And after losing my son, that's the story of my life. God bless Gary Webb. I've been trying to tell this, and other DEA agents are now coming out trying to tell this story.
Let me take a break. When we come back, we got a lot of people who disagree with all of this.
Okay. Keep in mind that after Gary Webb did this interview, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, everyone, the Washington Post, all set upon him and tried to destroy him. They wouldn't work with him. They wouldn't look at his files. They simply wanted to destroy him. It shows you how deep the CIA and the National Intelligence Agencies control the media. That's why you should never just believe automatically anything the media says. We have Sophia from New York on the line. Hi, Sophia. It's your turn. What would you like to share with us?
Hi, Gary. Thanks for taking the call. It is my belief that if a healthy person is told that he has cancer, he will get cancer just from worrying. Therefore, people with cancer should not be told they have the disease. Instead, they should be sent to a nutritionist, to a holistic doctor. I've seen with my own eyes on your retreat, a great person run that could not walk 3 miles. I met him. He had to use the puffer. He did the marathon, and he believed, you made him believe, that he can be cured. And I'm overjoyed to know that he's doing well. So something is very wrong letting the patient, people know that they have cancer.
Okay. I would share a different perspective. See if this makes sense, Sophia. I believe that to the best that medicine can be, it's through its diagnosing of people, not the treatment so much, but the diagnosing, yes. Because if a person suddenly finds that they lack energy, they're losing weight, they have excruciating pain somewhere in the body, if you didn't do the diagnosing and you didn't determine the nature of the disease and you didn't share that with the patient, then there's a high probability they would die. So by denying that a person has a disease, how are you supposed to help them? Now, there are times when different medicines or medical therapies can make a big difference. Not all medicine is bad. Not all therapies are ineffective or dangerous. There are times when they can be life-saving, especially with emergency medicine. And a lot of people who end up with a heart attack or a stroke, are you going to say, there's nothing wrong with you? Of course, you must say you've had a stroke or you've had a heart attack. Then it's how do you work with them once they know they have a condition that has happened? Because that can be cathartic. It can be that moment when now they're in enough pain to change. You've heard me mention that we're not going to change as a society. Individuals will certainly change and have and are. And about 5%, and that's not a few people. You're still talking about 17 million people who are actively engaged in very healthy thoughts and actions and social commitments and family dynamics every day. But the majority of people won't make positive choices because they feel that on this day, in this hour, they're not the ones who are going to suffer. And indeed, they won't until they do. So once the crisis comes, at that moment that they've had the heart attack, they've been diagnosed with diverticulitis, they have arthritis in their joint, now we've gotten their attention. So look at this point of view, Sophia. A disease can be a wake-up call. It can allow them to look in the mirror. Instead of seeing something artificial looking back, they see the full magnitude of what they have helped participate in creating. Now, it's not about blaming. It's about recognition. Because once you recognize that you are at a certain level of health or lack of health, you can then be proactive in how you choose to change that from a noun, cancer, to a verb, cancering. A noun you're not going to change, a verb you can. It's in your hands to change. So I don't deny that people are ever sick or that the diseases they've been diagnosed with are real. To the contrary, I just don't encourage them to suffer emotionally as they're suffering physically. That is a compounding negative. Instead, I suggest everything positive and possible and then give them the challenge, okay, you didn't pay attention to your diet, you didn't pay attention to exercise, you didn't pay attention to the quality of your relationship, and all these things you didn't pay attention to, now let's pay attention. Now let's build the ideal life, the ideal relationship, the ideal creative project. And to do that, you have to be 100% focused upon what is possible. Not the past, but what is possible going forward. And hence you detach from looking at yourself as a victim. The fact that you have cancer doesn't mean that you have to act as if you're a cancer patient. You're simply a person going through a stage of life that you're now challenged, and this challenge can strengthen you. This young woman who we heard from earlier, Claire Wineland, she made a very important statement in the middle of what she was saying about how she was achieving something. She wasn't sitting there focused upon her limitations. Her disease did not prevent her from feeling, seeing, and believing. That's important. So the next time we think about we're limited because of a disease, understand that there are those who will not allow themselves to be limited because of a disease. But don't deny the disease. That is very important that we're honest and recognize the disease so we can then empower people with positive energy instead of disempowering them by making them feel like a victim of that disease. Thank you, Sophia, and thank all of you for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.
Whatever you want to do is all.